Our first guest today is Tom Gimbel on the Wintrust Business Lunch, the founder and CEO at LaSalle Network. Tom has an op-ed piece in the Chicago Business section. And among other things, he says, I'm not for higher taxes in Illinois or Chicago. He says, but the bigger issue facing businesses in Chicago is the violence. Enough is enough. Shootouts on expressways, restaurant districts having shootings, carjackings at an all-time high. What's next? The Batman villain Bane to take over Soldier Field during a Bears game. Is it that bad? Tom, welcome back. How are you?
Good to be with you, John. I think it's worse. I know people that are that were diehard city people thinking about taking their families out of the city. They don't feel that their kids are safe. There was a shooting last night, I think, at North and Sheffield. I think a police officer was shot. The city is out of control.
Stand by. I'm still here. My headphones just got unplugged. Answer this for me. Do you think that as bad as it is the perception worse than the reality, Tom?
The perception was worse than the reality 20 years ago when you'd go to Europe and you'd say Chicago and people would go boom, 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 and point their finger at a gun. Today, it's real. I mean, everybody is 2 degrees away from a carjacking, John. And I genuinely believe that everyone in the city is 2 degrees away from it, knows somebody who's 2 degrees away for a carjacking. There was a shootout on the Eisenhower on Lakeshore Drive. When do you ever remember that happening in Chicago, John? I've been here for 49 years. I don't remember it.
I don't remember it either. So then what do you propose, or do you suggest something can be done about it?
Yeah, I think the real problem is that Mayor Lightfoot has a woe is me. There's nothing more that can be done. Instead of saying, who could do it better? What are we doing wrong? And we've got to do it. To me, it's a pretty simple, an overstatement, but a simple process is, number one, come out and say, we support the police. This is not May of 2020 anymore. And we have got to step out and say, we support the guys in blue and women in blue, and they are the people that protect us, number one. Number two, we've got to hire a heck of a lot more policemen and police women. And we have to do that, and it's going to be harder now than ever because of salaries and pricing and inflation and everything else. We've got to do that. Then, because of the George Floyd and those other situations, she needs to come out and say, and we're going to do more psychological training for our police officers so they're more prepared and they understand what's going on in the diverse racial areas that we have in the city. And then she's got to get out of her ivory tower and go down to where the neighborhoods are that really need her. And if we can start to stabilize that, we'll be doing better to stabilize the areas that didn't used to be problem areas.
This is a business show, so what's the business connection here?
That companies are not going to, A, not going to stay, B, not going to come here, and C, we're losing labor already. We're going to have less people wanting to come here to get a job. If you can go someplace that's safe, why would you go someplace that's dangerous? If you're going on a vacation, do you want to go to Iraq or do you want to go to Europe? And we're looking at something, I'm not doing a play on the Chi-Rac thing, but this is, if you have an 18-year-old kid that you're sending off to college, and you can send them to a city that doesn't have carjackings and shootings, or you can send them to a place that does, where are you sending your kid?
What do you say, though, to the fact that there are a lot of people still downtown? I'm talking to you from downtown right now. There are still tourists that come downtown. This may be the perception versus reality part of it. Everything you said is true, but it is also true. It is also true that the city is quite safe for a lot of people almost all of the time.
No, I think I don't agree with those comments. Number one, we're going to lose tourism as more and more of the shops on Michigan Avenue leave and don't come back. So we're still in an after effect of people want to get out and be in the city, but the city isn't what it was 2 years ago. And that's just a fact as you see the vacancies and you see stores that aren't here, number one.
Yeah.
Number two, as taxes go up, you're going to see less business here. It's a fact of what's moving out of the state versus what's coming in. And people still went to Detroit 20 years ago, John. It just wasn't what Detroit was in the 50s and 60s. And I think the mayor actually has the attitude of what you're saying. It's still Chicago, and people are still coming here. That's great until they're not. And when you start to see there's a problem, the majority of Chicagoans, they don't feel safe after dark. They don't. I'm in the city right now. We make sure that if people are going to the parking garage or to the L, that they walk out in pairs. They don't go out alone anymore. We weren't doing that 5 years ago.
I think about that whenever I'm walking downtown now at dark, in the morning and in the evening. And I almost always am, now, especially now that the days are shorter. I come here when it's dark. I leave here when it's dark. And I'm a 6 foot tall man. I could probably take care of myself.
But not with a gun. John, I'm sick. You've seen me. I'm sick.
No, let me finish my thought. And yet I'm apprehensive. I'm on alert as I move about. And you're right. Nobody's got a chance against somebody with a gun. Channel 2 did a story the other day, and they were talking about the Mag Mile and how many storefronts are still vacant. Vacant. Now, not that there aren't a lot of customers. There's no store there.
Uh-huh. You hit the nail right on the head, John. And I'll tell you what, I don't even like to. I used to go for runs in the morning. I wouldn't go with my headphones in if it's dark anymore because you can't hear somebody coming up behind you.
And you you think this is a problem principally for the mayor right now?
I think it's the mayor's only problem.
Yeah.
If you build it, they will come. She has to get focused on crime, and she has to come out publicly and say, "We need the police. We support the police. And I have your back." And you know what? Out of tens of thousands of police officers, there may be somebody who does something inappropriate. Just like there are. Look at Bill Gates is doing inappropriate things, they said, at Microsoft. And that's a white-collar company, and he was doing things inappropriate. And then with police officers, I get it. There's a difference between death and sexual harassment. But the fact of the matter is that you have people in any job, and there's always going to be bad apples. They don't sour the bunch. And police in overall are good, and we need them. And since we've stopped supporting them, the city has gone downhill.
Tom Gimbel has a piece at ChicagoBusiness.com dated October 7th. It's not the taxes. It's the violence. Okay, Tom, let's talk again. Thanks for your time.
You got it. Stay safe, John.
Philip Weiss joins us now on the Wintrust Business Lunch. He's the president of SciFarth at Work. Hi, Philip. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
We were talking earlier this morning about schools having Halloween parties and the complication it creates. You say that's a complication for employers now too, huh?
Absolutely. Prior to COVID, about a third of the companies we surveyed had some kind of party or event celebrating Halloween. That really is primarily a team building or a camaraderie related opportunity. With COVID, that tradition went a little bit dormant last year. But it's coming back strong, and what we found from clients and companies coming to us that already have hosted these events is they've been very COVID conscious, outdoor events, open tents with heaters, that kind of thing, but less careful in other compliance areas, such as warning people to keep the costumes respectful, ensuring that they are aware of people's sensitivities from a religious standpoint. So what's happened is there's been this tunnel vision, get people back together, and less awareness of the kind of risks that are way outside of that whole COVID sphere.
Boy, it makes you wonder maybe it's not even worth it. I mean, it sounds like you're taking the fun out of the holiday there, Philip.
You know what? That argument is one that's been made. And, there's no one response to it other than to say companies should be balancing, in our view. That is, you want to have those opportunities. You want people to be a little bit more casual. The reality is, of course, we've seen at least a dozen big-ticket lawsuits because companies didn't at least plan carefully, didn't send a memo out saying, you can be creative with that costume, but don't have the naughty priest or nun get up. And in one case, for example, a company came to us because they had one employee who came dressed as what he termed an illegal alien. Another employee came as an immigration agent with a giant net, and he chased the coworker around. That upset about half the workforce and led to a lawsuit. So some of these lines are pretty clear, and a little bit of a warning goes a long way to have a safe and festive event. Mm.
Boy, I would have, okay, that one I would have advised against.
we agree there.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, can you give us other examples? I mean, traditionally, I think the ones that we think of when we think of ones across the line were either too sexy or sexual, or maybe too violent, too creepy.
Yes, and those are the two that may not necessarily rise to the level of a lawsuit, but could easily be a company policy violation. Because the idea is you have this dress code that might apply every other day of the year. You don't want to give people this huge Halloween waiver that results in clothing that is really too revealing, so to speak, or offensive. And what's interesting about the revealing stuff, John, is not only can it be its own policy violation because you're simply exposing too much skin, so to speak, but it invites comments or it allows for comments because people are actually going to talk about the costume as well. Those comments are their own standalone potential policy violation. So you're right that the revealing stuff, the risque stuff, has a series of risks it can create and something to be thinking about. And that's why companies should at least let people know, we want you to feel that you have an opportunity to express yourself, mm-hmm. but think about the offense, think about the typical dress code, because in many ways it applies to Halloween as well.
Well, in the schools, sometimes the parents will opt the kid out of the activities or the day because of religious reasons. I'm not exactly sure which faith would find something in particular so offensive that they wouldn't participate, but evidently some parents interpret their religion that way or anticipate what's going to happen at school that way. Are there religious barriers in the workplace as well?
Yes, and it's a really good example. And there are a number because you know, anybody who can assert their own sincerely held belief at least is going to be allowed to raise that objection. But, for example, many people who are Jehovah's Witnesses, they don't celebrate any holiday of any sort. And so companies should know that even the Federal Employment Agency, the EEOC, has said, you have a Halloween party, someone steps up and says, I'm a Jehovah's Witness. I don't want to be required to attend. You want to be respectful of that request. And really, this goes to a larger issue, which is, to your point, we want to have opportunities for people to come together after work, outside of work, mark important events. However, making those events absolutely mandatory is always risky, and this is one example of why that's the case.
My high school French club had a float in the parade. Since we were the French club, we had a guillotine and we chopped the head off of the opposing team's football player. I wonder if that would appear to be too violent in today's environment.
Yeah, so that's another really useful example, John. On the company side, it's probably not the best way to prevent people in your team to have nightmares at night. It may not be an actual legal risk per se, but where we see it being more of a problem is on the advertising side, on the marketing side. So many companies want to make this sort of October splash, do a real nice get-up in their window display. Yeah. One company came to us from Southern Illinois because it was a kids' clothing store. And in their window display, they positioned one extra mannequin with a severed levitating head, thinking it would just be hilarious for the local community. Many of their longtime customers said, we're not shopping until you cover that thing up or take it out of the window. So even a moment where you kind of test out your display ideas in the local community can avoid that kind of headache. So that's maybe more of a marketing risk than a business and employment risk per se.
Yeah, I see your point. Philip Weiss is the president of SciFarth at Work, SceyFarth, scifarthatwork.com. Okay, Philip, as always, interesting information. Thanks for your time.
Great, and thanks for having me, John.
Well, here's another business category maybe you haven't thought about before here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Joining us is Mott Smith. He's the CEO of Amped Kitchens. AmpedKitchens.com is their website. Mott, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Great to be here, John. Thanks for having me.
So your business is a kitchen or kitchens, not for the average homemaker, but for people who are in the food businesses. Is that right?
Yeah, it's exactly right. Amped Kitchens is to the world of food makers what apartment buildings are to housing. You know, if you're out there looking for a place to make some product that is about to be for sale at Whole Foods or Costco or something like that, in the old world, you'd have to go out and make a multi-million-dollar investment in your own facility or contract with somebody to make your goods. Amped Kitchens provides an opportunity for companies like that to move right in and within a matter of weeks instead of years start producing and at a cost of, you know, thousands of dollars versus millions.
So give me an example of somebody who would use you and what I would see in the store.
Sure. Well, I mean, one of my favorite examples is actually the Beyond Burger, which a lot of people have heard of. One of the first plant-based burgers to come to market. Beyond Meat, a well-established company, needed a place to manufacture the burger at a pilot stage, meaning before they had completely perfected the formula, but still they wanted to sell it and get feedback on how they were doing. And so they came to Amped in Los Angeles and manufactured the Beyond Burger for national sales out of a small kitchen at one of our buildings there, and perfected the formula, then moved it out to a contract manufacturer. That's very typical of what we expect to see in Chicago as well. Mm.
So it's a fairly large scale then. I mean, you said that that's sort of their beta version of the product, but still, that's more than a mom and pop shop, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, one of the things that we do at Amped is we kind of democratize access to food production. So not only do you have companies like Beyond Meat, you've got companies like, we've got several Chicago-based firms, a company called Hello Cocktails, another one called Two Fish Crab Shack, others that are more mom and pops that don't have years and millions of dollars to spend on manufacturing that are coming to us to get access to exactly the same sort of capacity that we were able to deliver to a Beyond Meat.
And so when you do that, is this for people who are doing it for production purposes, but not for immediate use? It's not like a restaurant has a supplemental kitchen, or are some restaurants actually using you for food prep in Chicago?
Yeah, what a great question. Yeah, there's been a proliferation of what are known as ghost kitchens. These are sort of delivery-only kitchens that have lines of cars and drivers outside ready to grab meals to deliver to people to eat right away. We do have a smattering of tenants who do that, but we really want to power companies that are doing production, just like you said. So we've got people doing goods that you could buy at supermarkets or farmers markets or on Amazon. Mm-hmm. We also have restaurants, though. One of the things that we discovered really clearly during the pandemic is that restaurants need a variety of channels for their goods, and often where their retail locations aren't necessarily set up for the kind of production they need to power their delivery businesses, their home order businesses. And so restaurants come to us in order to get very flexible production capacity. And one of the things that we've seen is restaurants can set up a kitchen at Amped and make some staple items that they can then ship out to multiple locations every morning and free up kitchen space for fresher items that need to be manufactured on the go.
Would I have my own space, like would I rent it for 6 months and nobody else would use my kitchen space?
Yeah, exactly. Again, think of it just like an apartment. If you're renting it from us, it's yours. You lock the door. Your sign goes on the front. It really is your home. It's your home manufacturing facility.
Yeah, no kidding. And then if I said I needed this many Viking ranges or whatever, I mean, do you customize it for me or do I have to sort of work with your staple setup?
Yeah, so we pride ourselves in offering flexibility and the ability to innovate and adapt. And so most of our tenants bring in their own equipment because if you're a beef jerky maker, you're going to use a certain thing. If you're making Russian cheese, you're going to use a different piece of equipment. What we do provide, though, is a very high level of service so that when you know you're bringing in your special fermenting device, for instance, we're set up to provide the hookups for it, the engineering for it, to make it as seamless and easy as possible for you to flip the on switch on that machine and start producing right away and not having to worry about becoming an expert in engineering or facilities yourself.
That's interesting that you mentioned beef jerky because we've interviewed a couple of times the gal that does Jilly's Jerky here in town. It's a recipe that her dad had. Now she's been doing it. She and her husband make it for the family. Everybody loves it. They amped up production. They're doing it in their kitchen.
Yep.
And suddenly the product's going well. Now they're having trouble keeping up. I mean, I don't know if Jillies is using your kitchen, but it sounds like she should.
I think I'll be calling her right after this interview. Thank you for that, Sean.
And by the way, her product is terrific. It is really delicious. And I can just see her sort of converting her house, which should be a house, into a place where, you know, she's trying to do production and then probably keep up with codes and standards. So it sounds like you would be the next logical step for somebody like that.
Yeah, you know, you nailed it. Her story, the Jillies story, is so typical of so many food companies. There's a family recipe. They start making it for friends. They start making it at farmers markets. Everybody goes crazy. They start selling it online. And what happens is, as soon as you sell your product to a market or to a website or to any third party who's then reselling your product, you're now in a category of wholesale food production where the standards are much higher because the health risks are much higher. Yeah. And as you noted, it's really tough for the average small business to comply with the rules, let alone even know what the rules are. And that's why Amped Kitchens exists, because you come to us, we're pre-inspected for 90% of the things mm-hmm. the wholesale inspectors care about. We're pre-approved for 90% of the things. We even have a USDA office on site. So for beef jerky in particular, getting a USDA inspection would be an essential. And most people who are producing out of their homes or even the smaller shared kitchens or the incubator kitchens that are out there, and there are quite a few great ones in Chicago, they cannot easily get USDA approval. Whereas if you come to Amped, that office is there, the inspector's already there, and I'm not saying it's an easy process, but it's a lot simpler than if you did it on your own.
Mott Smith is the CEO at Amped Kitchens. They're on Dickens Avenue in Chicago. Visit ampedkitchens.com. Good on you, Mott. Great idea. We'll be in touch, but thanks for your time today.
I'm going to have some of that Jillies beef jerky. Thank you.
For some reason, I'm hungry right now. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. More business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A ransomware attack hit Chicago-based Ferrara Candy earlier this month at the height of Halloween candy season. One of the company's candies is the iconic candy corn. Crane says the attack was detected on October 9th and encrypted some of the company's systems. Ferrara has been working with outside specialists to restore systems and says its factories continued limited operations. They've been coming back online on a rolling basis. Chicago tech startup Hunt Club has raised $10 million in a funding round. The company, which was founded in 2014 as a staffing firm for leadership roles with titles of director and above. Hunt Club uses a network of 12,000 professionals to help tech companies fill those roles. According to Cranes, the company has made nearly 6 million connections across 700 clients. Hunt Club has raised a total of $14.5 million since its founding. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
With the business of food, here's Steve Alexander.
Yesterday, we talked about the bird flu. Today, it's African swine fever.
It is critical to keep this disease out of our country.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack responding to news that African swine fever, which wiped out millions of pigs as it moved from Africa to Russia to China and other parts of Asia to Europe, and now somehow has made it across the Atlantic.
We've got African swine fever confirmed in both the Dominican Republic and Haiti.
That is Dr. Liz Wagstrom.
I'm the chief veterinarian at the National Pork Producers Council.
And wow, those poor people in Haiti. With all they've been through, and now this?
Correct. It's been a devastating situation between the earthquake, the political instability, food insecurity, which of course is just contributed to by having sick and dying pigs.
And if ASF gets into the United States?
It would be absolutely devastating. We believe there would be up to a $50 billion impact on the pork industry, and it would result in many, many of our farmers not being able to stay in business.
So what do we do?
We just need to make sure that consumers know it's a pig-only disease. It doesn't affect humans, food safety, other animals. And for our farmers and veterinarians out there, just to make sure that they do everything they can to keep their farms as biosecure as possible. I'm optimistic that everybody is at high alert to do their best to keep it out.
And what you can do if you're traveling abroad, don't lie on the customs forms when it asks you if you've been on a farm or around farm animals or products.
Absolutely. You know, we're working closely with Customs and Border Protection, trying to make sure that they're following up. If somebody answers those questions, that they have brought in food or been on a farm.
Let's keep it out of the United States because it could be really bad for all of us. From the farm to your belly, today is National Seafood Bisque Day. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Amy Guth is too. Let's talk a little bit about cryptocurrency. What's the news here, Amy?
Yeah, so this has kind of been long in the works, but Facebook has officially announced their cryptocurrency wallet called Novi. We heard about this a couple years ago, even. They were looking to launch a particular type of cryptocurrency called Libra Coin. That's been shelved for now. They've hired Coinbase to help with the logistics of that. So Coinbase is going to store the cryptocurrencies and help encrypt it so it's a secure transfer. But Facebook says that this is a small pilot, so it's just rolled out to a select users, but it is in the U.S. and it is also in Guatemala. People can send cryptocurrency funds instantly abroad and securely and without fees, according to Facebook. So that's a big move for Facebook. Where, you know, they've been talking about getting into the payment system game and to cryptocurrency for a while, and Novi is now here, at least in the U.S. and Guatemala.
It's funny because I was listening to another commercial on this radio station that Andy Mazur was doing, and he was mentioning that cryptocurrency is being used by an NBA team as a form of ticket purchase or payment. And every time you hear another one of these stories, you think, this is not going away. You really get the feeling this pendulum is still swinging in the other direction, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think, to me, the moment where I thought, okay, now this just took a giant leap forward, was when we started to hear about large hedge fund companies and big financial firms using some of their resources to participate in cryptocurrency trades and cryptocurrency investments. I thought, okay, that if the professionals are getting involved, you know, we know that this is here to stay. Yeah. And this is for real.
Facebook, here's a headline, Facebook to hire 10,000 people in the EU to build the metaverse. I should tell you, I don't know what I just said, but maybe you do.
That's okay. The metaverse is kind of a weird thing. And it's the idea is like an augmented reality universe in which, like, you and I could go to a meeting together and it will look like we're sitting in the room together. And then you could go walk over to a Starbucks and have a meeting with someone else. And I could go to a cafe and have a meeting with someone else. It's kind of this idea of like this augmented reality universe where you use an avatar that to represent yourself and you move around and interact with other people's avatars. So Facebook has been talking about that for a little while, but they have just announced that they, as you said, going to hire 10,000 workers in Europe. The reason they said they're really looking at Europe is they said, you know, the quality of the talent there and the universities there. So that kind of hurts a little here in the US. I know there's lots of talented people here too, but nonetheless, they're doing that. They said it could take a couple of years, maybe even up to 5 years to be fully staffed up. So we don't really have a timeline of when we're going to be seeing this kind of metaverse idea. But they also said, this is kind of interesting, that it won't be owned or run by one company. I think it's kind of like the idea of a hashtag, that it's sort of owned by the people and whoever's using it is part of the ownership of it. So it'd be very interesting to see what happens there and how that begins to roll out, kind of what the first bit of it is. I mean, I'm immediately thinking of the Sims games from the 90s and early 2000s.
Right. But my question is, and maybe you don't know the answer to this because it's just so new, but if I generate an avatar and you generate an avatar and we interact as live people represented by our avatars, are we doing this for entertainment or is this how we're going to do some sort of business function?
Well, I'm sure there will be plenty of entertainment functions and social functions. I know Burning Man made something kind of like this during the pandemic to replicate their festival. And it was kind of, if you looked inside, it looked like you were standing in the desert and you could walk up to different stages. And You could see there was a lot of people standing around some and not as many around others. So it's that same kind of idea, but I'm sure there would be a business application. Say you have a team in Tokyo and a team in Chicago, maybe you could all kind of be in the same room together by avatar.
One last quick headline, Instagram's letting users co-author posts. What's this mean?
Yeah, this is kind of an interesting thing. And there's a couple of other little details that they're rolling out that I thought were really compelling. Essentially, if say you and I took a picture together and we both wanted to post it to Instagram, we could do that and co-author it. And the comments and likes would show up on both of our posts. So we're essentially sharing ownership of that content, which I think is really interesting, especially as we see more brands collaborating with influencers and celebrities, things like that. They're also adding a fundraiser function and the ability to upload content from a desktop, which I think just for small businesses, that's really going to be a big step forward there.
You know, that sounds so fundamental. It's kind of surprising that Facebook and all the platforms haven't had a sort of shared post application like you're talking about. That makes sense, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And there's the ability to you know, like denote that a post is sponsored or it's a collaboration, or you could tag somebody. But the idea of sharing comments and likes, I think, is really, really interesting and be interesting to see that. So that's rolling out. And then these other two features will follow. So all week, we're going to see these new features rolling out for Instagram.
That's Amy Guth. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.